Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 698, January 2024.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host, Jason Snell. This is an episode about a television series on Apple TV Plus that's been on for 2 seasons, and we haven't done an episode about it. And as the second season finished, I talked to a lot of people who were like, you know what? I really like that show. More people should watch that show. And I heard a lot of people were like, oh, I started it, and then I just sort of like let it drop off, and I didn't know that it came back. And was anyway, it's Foundation, based in quotation marks on the novels, also in quotation marks, the books by Isaac Asimov, and it's sort of the brainchild of David S. Goyer. We're going to talk about it. We're going to start with a pre-spoiler horn part where we're going to talk sort of in broad terms about it, maybe make you more interested in checking it out or going back to it if you haven't watched the first 2 seasons, and then we'll talk about the first 20 episodes after the spoiler horn. Let me introduce my panelists who are going to talk about Foundation with me on this episode. Glenn Fleischman returns to the program. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. I may or may not be governed by any laws on this episode. Sorry.
That's right. That's Glenn the 8th. Dan Morin the 14th is here. Hi, Dan.
Sorry, folks. Beheading's been canceled.
Heather Berber at the 4th is here as well. Hello, Heather.
Hey, everybody. So excited to be here to talk about a lot of robots, or maybe just one robot.
Ooh. And the one and only John Syracuse is here. Hi, John.
I actually do have an opening statement, but now I can't tell whether it should come before or after the spoiler horn.
Well, I don't know, John. Do you want to amend your opening statement for the spoiler horn, or do you want to hold it?
I think I can do it if you allow me to describe what I think is the premise of the show, which I think is laid out season 1, episode 1.
Go for it.
Okay.
Go for it.
All right. So I'll start by saying I didn't read the books. So this is just from the TV show.
Podcast is over.
What, you didn't read like all 65 of them?
No.
I'm stunned.
Like seven.
Not a one. So I'm just going off the TV show.
And it is the most, I mean, people out there are like, it's outrageous that they are not using the Sega. It's like, it's an impossible task.
Would you like to film faithfully someone doing them. Academia for
men in spaceships smoking cigars and having long conversations is basically like half the book. Right. We talked about it all in episode 272. You can go back in time and listen to that episode where we talked about the Foundation novels. They are interesting raw material for someone to turn into a story, which is what this is. Okay, go ahead, John.
Yeah, and that means I didn't even know the premise. I knew the name of the show and knew it looked kind of space opera-y, and I was in, right? So I didn't take much, but I didn't have any ideas going in. And I'll start by saying that I do like the show. Obviously, I've watched 2 seasons of it, and I will watch the third, and I continue to like it. So don't take what I'm about to say as me trying to say that this is a bad show or I don't like it, that you shouldn't watch it. But there's always a but. The premise of this show is dumb. And to the extent that the show
that's the part they licensed from Isaac Asimov.
And to the extent that the show can avoid the premise of the actual show, I enjoy it. But as soon as it reminds me that premise exists, I get angry again. And here is my understanding of the premise, which is basically outlined in the very first episode of the first season. There's a galactic empire with a monarchy going on in it, ruling over everything. And there's this guy, Harry Seldon, who has this thing called psychohistory, which I totally recognize as an Isaac Asimov era sci-fi word. I'm like, okay, all right. Yeah. And it basically is a bunch of mumbo jumbo math that tells him the empire is going to fall. I know this with a mathematical certainty. And what we should do is create a foundation of knowledge so that when the dark times come, they don't last as long because we will have saved the knowledge of humanity before we all destroy ourselves. And that is the foundation, right?
It's not quite
Asterisk. That's the understanding of the episode of like the premise.
Right.
Well, I mean,
what the premise really is, the empire is going to fall. and there are and it might last thousands of years. But using psychohistory, I think we can chart a course with this foundation where we can make some other events occur along the way that will shorten the length of the Dark Ages.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah.
And it's not necessarily just by keeping, you know, knowledge alive. It's actually actively making alterations in the politics of the galaxy in order to reduce
crisis
the time
points
of the Dark
or
Ages.
Fixed points in Doctor Who's
crises. Right. Yes.
Okay. So here's the problem that I have every time I think about that, and it makes me angry.
The psychohistory is nonsense.
Well, obviously, psychohistory is nonsense, but whatever. Okay. But here's the thing: you have a galactic empire ruled by a monarch. You don't need some weird mathematical reason to fight against that. And every time they use that as some kind of motivating force, it's like, you don't need to tell me about psychohistory. He's a bad emperors are bad. You can overthrow and rebel against them without any math at all. I swear to you. And every time they're like, well, this crisis point, and Harry says this, and it's like, no, you don't need to involve that at all. Just rebel against the Empire. They're bad.
Haven't you seen Star Wars, people in Foundation?
like, there's no math involved.
It's the twist that I like about the show is that the people, the movers at the center, don't need to be the rebels. Like, they know the Empire is falling. That's not a question. They know. They don't need to do anything.
You didn't need
to
do any math to figure that one out either, by the way.
Right. So instead, they're like, how do we cushion the fall so that that there's less chaos in the Dark Ages that follow? I think that's interesting. As a premise.
Soft landing, if you
will. They're rebelling against an empire, and every time they get into the politics of like how we're going to do this, and because Harry says this, so just be a rebellion. Just be honest about the fact that you're a rebellion. And so, and honestly,
But I like the nuance there, John, that what's happening is to an emperor, the statement that the empire is going to fall is rebellion. And then Harry Seldon's like, no. It's just math. And I enjoy that, right? Like, it's because from the...
I'm reminded of the line from, I think it's The Hobbit, where Gandalf says, surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you helped bring them about, right? Harry is helping bring them about, which is part of the premise. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But it's like, you don't need the math. You don't need the precedent. And they kind of lean into that in season two, which we'll talk about with the whole sort of missionary, you know, the missions of Brother Constant and everything, getting people to join the Foundation clearly sets it for what it is. We're just doing a rebellion. Just do a rebellion and please never say the word psychohistory again.
It's an academic rebellion.
I would also like to make the argument, if I could, that those are all the explicit themes, but there's a whole bunch of implicit themes that just kind of ride that train that are a lot more interesting. I think about identity and intelligence and agency that the show's about, which is why I couldn't stop thinking about it after season one and was so excited for season two. So, yeah.
I also think John's premise is actually fundamentally flawed, is that actually everyone, there's a massive amount of rebellion going on, and everyone does think the Empire is bad, and it's the Empire's, it's a mystical feature, or not mystical, but like sort of magical creature at the center of it all that we'll talk about, that seems to be holding things together at a level that should be impossible. So you have the outer reaches are falling apart. You have apparently a plot that we will talk about after the spoiler horn. Like, everything is falling apart. The center will not hold. The center is Trantor. It will not hold. So everyone is in a state of moving towards rebellion, and everyone does agree the Empire is bad. So I don't think that's the issue.
I'm not saying they don't agree. I'm just saying they have this psychohistory thing is just baggage. It doesn't help their cause. It doesn't explain anything.
I disagree. The psychohistory part is that Harry says it's going to fall, and all these other rebellions are the bad rebellions because when it happens, it'll be terrible. My weird rebellion, which I'm casting as not being a rebellion at all, even though it is the good rebellion because it'll be shorter.
Yeah, I would be happy if it turns out the psychohistory is all BS and Harry was snowing everybody, but it seems the show is saying, no, psychohistory is real.
The only thing about psychohistory that's real in this case is that using mathematics to predict the future and the path, right? Like, it's not necessarily even about rebellion or not. It's about... it's, you know, fate versus free will in some ways. I mean, I think that the larger thing here is, like, you know, this is essentially Asimov's parable on, like, the, you know, the fall, decline and fall of the Roman Empire, except space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And I think that, you know, psychohistory in this is sort of a MacGuffin, right? Like, because it is the match that gets lit that sort of catalyzes all of these rebellions that are like, well, we're never going to be able to pull this off, right? Because this empire is so vast and so huge and so powerful that rebelling against it is just like you're going to get swatted like a fly. Like, and somehow Harry Seldon proves to be the person who can sort of motivate those people to actually do it. And more to the point, as Glenn is saying, like, to cast it as a way that is not a rebellion, which if it did was an outward, you know, just sort of flagrant Rebel Alliance style, we're fighting against the evil empire, they would just crush it. They would just crush it. Would be over.
But large empires like this, like, that's why I'm saying you don't need math, because you can just say, look, this big empire is going down anyway. It's decadent. It's overextended. Things aren't going well. Like, again, no math required, just a basic historian.
But you got to bring it down the right way.
Okay.
Yeah. That's.
I want to move on to things that other than John's complaint about the premise of the show. But I will say this. I enjoy the idea that the act of saying the empire will fall is the greatest rebellion of all, right?
Yeah.
The impossibility that the incredibly powerful thing will end, and being Harry Seldon, just this academic, and saying, oh, I ran the numbers, it's absolutely going to fall, that empowers everybody who's thinking of rebelling. The idea that there will be a rebellion, it will fall. It's just a question of how. And then everybody out there, including Harry Seldon, is playing the game of, well, how is this going to happen? And the Emperor is desperately fighting against it, even though we know.
Or is he?
Other
or
things
is
that
he
are,
fighting against?
When
it,
the fall is all that's left, it matters a great deal.
It's
so. The other thing about the show, just to set some of the premises here, is we have a bunch of actors. It's set over hundreds, if not thousands, of years, but we have a lot of actors who keep being in the show, and there are some holograms, and there are a bunch of clones. And that is part of the weird and intriguing premise of the show, is that the empire is ruled by an emperor. He's a clone. And then he has at his side his brothers, Brother Dusk and Brother Dawn. They are also him, a little younger, not yet grown into the main emperor role, and a little older, having retired from the emperor role, played by the same three actors in both seasons. And that's an interesting quirk as well. And then we also have some people who are, in addition to the holograms, there's some relativistic, you know, and sleeper ship kind of stuff that get people from time A to time B. But I one of the things I admire about it is the show trying to find ways to keep actors around when otherwise, you know, halfway through the season, you'd have to change to a whole bunch of new actors because, like, a few hundred years have passed and
they all
died.
The genetic dynasty, I don't think, is even mentioned. It's not a Asimovian thing at all.
No, but it's brilliant. We only get Cleon in the books. I have, by the way, read way too much of the books, and I'll talk about that when we get into it, why that's it's a problem for me, but I'll talk about it after the spoilers. One of the things that I thought was fascinating about the scope of it is that they tried to present, you know, Asimov was a creature of his time, right? And so isn't it him who wrote the story? I should have it in front of me about, we get to a point in the United States where, only one voter decides who's going to be the president anymore, because basically they know everyone's going to vote. So one guy is the deciding factor, one woman or whoever in the story. It's like always men, of course, right? Because of the time. And he gets the vote, and then the decision, you know, whichever way he goes, he could elect a tyrant or a democratic person. And I think Asimov was in an era when he wrote these when it seemed like everything would be predictable at some point. And so I love kind of the play in this series about that very bad and totally disproven idea. Like, we know that chaos theory does not exist at that point, but also so many other variables about how everything breaks down over time. There's no predictable way to, you know, to chart something over the future.
That's, like, they were wrong about that sci-fi premise, and that we're just around the corner, we'll be able to mathematically predict everything. But I personally believe in an entirely deterministic universe. It's just not possible to, from within that same universe, store and compute enough to know what the next state is going to be. So it's
practically
impossible.
Well, I don't know if that's
impossible.
True. The quantum, I thought the quantum flux
Okay. Off.
Anyway, but there's a space. The there's a space topic. Between the Asimovian idea that things could be fully predictable and the notion that we live in a deterministic universe. There is a space for drama.
Okay, so let's, what do we need to say other than arguing about psychohistory, which isn't that important in the show, to be honest.
Thankfully,
it really isn't. We sort of surf over the waves of it and use it to get more character-based drama that you would have in a modern TV show. But, like, if we're trying to tell people, to watch this show or re-engage with it, think about what you would say. I will go first and just say, they spent a lot of money on this show, and it shows, because this is a widescreen space opera sci-fi epic, and it looks great. It is one of the best looking pieces of filmed science fiction I have ever seen. And there are so many different weird spaceships, weird planets, weird architecture, weird sets. It is just some weird gadgets too. It is beautiful, well done, well spent money on having it look good. So just from that level, I'd say it's pretty remarkable. And then, you know, my feeling is that that the story accelerates, and in season two is even much more gripping than it is. I think it's a slow burn in season one, and in season two they really figured out what the right pace is. What else are we to say to people?
One thing, Dan, that I really appreciate about the show, and we talked a little bit about scope. I think this show learned a lot, and it learned the right things from something like Game of Thrones in terms of both its production, right? Like, we've seen a lot of fantasy shows with varying degrees of budget and production, you know, design and stuff like that. And this really took the idea of like, hey, we've spent all this time creating these fantasy worlds that people want to live in because they're so detailed. We should apply that same thing to sort of this far future setting. And I think they do it with great effect. But I think the sort of other thing that goes in terms of the Game of Thrones influence here is creating these interesting storylines that are connected but disparate, where, you know, you have these characters off doing different things and having their own particular little dramas, and they link in with what's going on in some of the other storylines. But those storylines, those characters may never directly intersect at all, but their impact is felt by the various characters, and the choices that they make, the decisions they make, are sort of ripple effects. And I think combining that with the fact that, unlike, and I, like Glenn, I read all these books, although it was a very long time ago, there are very few characters in my memory that stand out in these books. And I think the show does a fantastic job of creating not only characters who are very dynamic and interesting, but also, to our point of earlier, from a book that did not really embrace the idea of anybody but a white man sort of making, you know, important decisions or important roles in the future, creating an incredibly diverse group of a cast of characters who are just intriguing and interesting and well-developed, well-fleshed out, fun. I think that's the other thing about this show that is kind of undersold in some places, is it's a really fun show, honestly. Like, as Jason said, they ratcheted up a bit in season two, but like, I think even season one's got a lot going for it in that regard. So there's if you're worried about being like really dry and boring, I think it is not, honestly. And I speak from the, like, we watched the first couple episodes when they aired and we paused because life, you know, got in the way, but we binged the rest of it, like, in the last couple months, and we had a great time. We really enjoyed it.
I think if you like sci-fi books, but you're not really as into movies and TV, this is worth watching, because it does the things that you see routinely in sci-fi books, where there's so much variety in the premise of sci-fi books, the scope of the galaxy and the planets and the different cultures or whatever. And when you see things on television and movies, it's like that narrows to this very skinny aperture, which is like Space Marines with guns, Star Wars is off to the side, then you've got Star Trek.
You can only afford these 5 sets in this one spaceship design, right?
People, characters, stories, plots, worlds, everything just falls into these nice, neat slots that basically are labeled Star Trek, Star Wars, Blade Runner, Space Marines. You know, it's like there's not that much variety. But if you read sci-fi books, there's so much more. And this show does not fall into that trap. Everything in this show does not fit neatly into one of those things, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, the people, the culture, the technology. Like, if you squint, you can see that's kind of like this, but kind of like that. But then you think, like, these are all in the same show. The water planet and these people and the mathematician and the city world and this desert place and that ship and those. This is all the same show. And, like, that's what reading a sci-fi book is like. Because sci-fi authors yeah. aren't constrained by budgets or, you know, what's going to get greenlit in Hollywood right. to have enough money to put it on the screen. You can just write the words. Every word costs the same yeah. amount, right? And this
and
show is
like Foundation.
That.
Is seemingly yeah. apparently
yeah
it's whatever its budget is it's a lot
yeah well that's what I'm saying this show yeah. is like yeah. we just took a sci-fi book but we gave him enough money to put everything that's in that sci-fi book on the screen and it is mm-hmm. refreshing and interesting and I think it keeps my interest because as we're jumping from storyline to storyline because I don't know the books I'm just excited to see what costume design they have next what world are they right. on what you know what things do the people in this scene accept as routine but that is fascinating for me and that's the feeling you get when you read a good sci-fi book where they're just like and they toss off stuff and you're like well that's super weird and interesting and what is that person going to be like when they talk to this person from this culture with that technology.
And again, I can't emphasize this enough. If you read the books, it wouldn't matter because it's not. It just does. It's not. There are little tiny scraps of things, but like it's not even following. I can't emphasize enough how the books are irrelevant to what story they're telling.
I have this thought about it too as we discuss this that they present the Empire not even at its height. So a lot of science fiction and fantasy, things are about to fall apart, right? Or things have already fallen. You're in a fallen position. You're trying to restore the greatness of, you know, like Wheel of Time or things like that, right? Or Lord of the Rings, where it's like everything is destroyed and every day is worse. Even when we bring the legendary empire back in Lord of the Rings and we have a king again, hooray, it's going to be worse because everyone's going to die and die younger, right? There's kind of this triumphalism, even though we know the empire, we kind of know this is not going to last, right? We know Ari Seldon is somehow right, but it's an incredible thing. And they talk about in a way that I feel like in Star Trek and Star Wars, you know, these are a lot of worlds are involved. Sometimes vast number of worlds are involved, but they even say like X trillion people. I forget what it was, 8 trillion people in the Empire across however many, 15,000 worlds. It's like the scope is huge and they talk about it and it seems like it. And I was always taken in the books about Trantor, which I think they depicted extremely well. And I think it'll be even for people coming to it, that it is a world that has no surface. It has it's endless depths of metal.
It's like
There's
Coruscant,
no,
but
it's
cooler.
It's cooler. Like
yeah. yeah, but more so. And that was when I read that in the books. I remember thinking like, oh my God, this is, you know, it's obviously a cautionary tale. Eventually there'll be not a square inch of Earth left on Earth. But the scope of it and the sky bridge, beanstalk, and then that's, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that surpassed later. So we're still watching an empire at its height with all this technology, and the glory of it is we know it's all going to fall, so there's a tension that we don't know when that happens, but we're not seeing like we're not seeing the aftermath. We're seeing the part that leads up to it told in really exquisite beauty.
Heather, any words for this mythical listener who's still on the fence about watching Foundation before we go to spoilers?
Well, as you each said all the things that I would say, the last thing that I would add would be, despite all the grandeur and the beauty and the amazing characters, what they also do beautifully well is have these amazing relationships between them, right? So the relationship between Harry and Gale is amazing, and the relationship between Gale and Salvor is amazing. So in that Star Trek way and the Star Wars way where you love... you really feel that intimacy between the characters. I think they also do that quite well. The acting is exceptional. I think the writing is really well, so good. So you still feel that intimacy of the relationships, even in this huge, amazing universe that's so gigantic right. that they've built. So, because it wouldn't be, I wouldn't want to watch it despite all of that if they didn't have that intimacy there. So I think they've done that incredibly well too.
I have right. one more little thing, which is that I sometimes get irritated with shows that are all mystery box. And once you find out what the central mystery is, well, then it all just plays out. And I would say Foundation, maybe season one a little bit less, season two certainly, there are a lot of mysteries, but they tell us a lot of things that you would think would be mystery very quickly. And in season two in particular, I know there were many moments where I thought, oh, that's it, and then I was totally wrong, or it unfolded in a way once I knew the secret that we didn't quite know what was going on, it's twisted into an entirely new interpretation. So I felt like there was something new in the storytelling. It wasn't kind of a trite, here's a mystery, we're going to find it, unveil it, and now you move on. So
it doesn't depend on that, certainly. It's like a tool in their arsenal rather than the raison d'etre of the
That's true.
Show.
And I like that.
And there's a lot of timey-wimey-ness in it, and I think they do it really well.
Yeah.
And they don't do it, it's not the only thing they do, but when they do it, it's unexpected and very clever and really serves the plot, never for its own sake.
Yeah, it wasn't. I was thinking about that same thing, Heather, about how there's a bit where it's like, there's a timey-wimey-ness that's, you feel like in another show would have been a, like a gotcha moment, like, aha, this happened, and now you didn't see that coming, and you're like, yeah, it's not actually that important. Like, it answers a question, but it doesn't really, like, it's not that important to the plot. There's no big twist about that, which I thought was, again, refreshing. Yeah.
There is literally a mystery box or more than one, spoiler. Yeah. So I don't know why I'm even saying there isn't a mystery box. There are mystery boxes, but not the kind you would expect.
Right. Most of the time is just forward, long duration, which is also interesting just to let this story play out over hundreds of years. All right, we're going to fire off the spoiler horn and start talking about details about Foundation, but you should check it out. It's on Apple TV Plus. We all think you should check it out, even John. Just don't get too caught up into the psychohistory.
Just ignore the psychohistory.
It's mumbo jumbo.
Just ignore it.
You don't need to major.
It's just a way into the story.
You don't need to major in psychohistory.
Unnecessary.
No, it's one of the most popular majors, I hear.
Although that is a fun aspect of this show. I always see Kieran Healy talking about it. If you are like a sociology professor, this is like your fantasy version of like, no, I can mathematically prove the empire is going to fall. I don't have to convince you.
Harry is just a nerd. I mean, he's just a nerd, right? He's just, he discovered this thing. He's a total nerd. He's got OCD and he's like, damn it, I understand this thing. I figured this thing out, and I've got to make everybody understand. That's
and
what
the Empire.
Why won't they listen to me?
Has a spoiler horn?
I'm going to tell the Emperor, and he's going to thank me for me saying that his empire is going to collapse.
Don't you understand?
Are we past the spoiler horn now?
No, we're not. Here it is.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So Harry Seldon's motivations are not entirely pure, considering the Empire killed his wife.
They're definitely
so
not
maybe
pure.
Maybe his academic reasoning is questionable.
Well, that's the thing about Harry is like Harry is setting himself up in some ways, but like the whole point of this is he withholds all this stuff, right? Like he is not telling anybody.
He's totally the bad good wizard.
That's one of the twists is that Harry Seldon has lots of secrets and is more he comes out and says, "Hey, I'm manipulative. I'm going to manipulate the entire galaxy." And everybody's like, "All right, Harry, I mean, at least you level with this." And then behind the scenes he's like, "They don't know just how manipulative I actually am."
Well, and it's how the Empire created their own downfall, right? By killing Harry's wife. Like if they just left him alone,
don't mess with the academics.
Right? Harry probably would have been fine, right?
If they left him alone, he never would have finished his dissertation.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
The whole time, yeah.
He would have been ABD forever.
30,000 years of barbarism, though, so it's good that
it could
they...
be.
Yeah,
that's
really,
not right.
I do wonder how much academics are really concerned with 30,000 years of barbarism that happen after they're dead.
They won't be around.
One of the brilliant things about this show, so I mentioned it, so Lee Pace gets to be in it.
Man.
And the rest of the Emperor Kleons get to be in it. The one that I was like, it's kind of a bummer, having read the books, kind of a bummer that, you know, we're going to get Jared Harris at the beginning, every now and then they're going to have him be a hologram. And and the show's
don't
like,
worry,
nope,
they can pour him into a new
body. We're not
going
to do that. We're going to have a clone version, and we're going to have the digitized versions of Harry that are working, you know, actively rather than passively with the, like in the books, which first off, I like that way better, that there isn't like a magic hologram every 100 years that says, I predicted this would happen. But instead it's an active kind of thing. And it means Jared Harris is always in the show. And like Jared Harris is such a great actor.
He is. He's
so charismatic.
Amazing.
So to have him be in it,
I had the same thought, Jason, because like I said, we watched the first two and then like took like a year off from this show. And like, I was like, because he dies in episode two. And I'm like, oh man, it's a real bummer that they're not going to have him in this show anymore.
And I thought they would just have him as a hologram. But when they poured him back into a new flesh and blood body and just said, shrug, I was like, okay, that's the way it's going to be show. I'm
fine.
And
then killed him again, like the next episode. Killed him again. Like,
don't
what are you doing?
There's plenty of Harry to go around.
He got better.
He's fine.
He's backed up on every hard drive in the galaxy.
Can I give a little, this is not an opening statement. This is a post spoiler horn statement is
yes.
And Dan, I wonder, since I know who has read all the books then, or I mean, I read a long time ago.
I've read all the books, but again, 30,
I don't know,
30
many
years
of
ago.
Them.
Heather, are you a
well? So here's what I did. I love the first season so much. I know it was a little slow, but I had never read them, so I actually went back to the beginning short stories.
Wow,
I have not read the Foundation stories, but. So for me, because I went back so far, I actually see so much of the early stuff in this, the evil empire, the robots, there's so much of the beginning stuff in this. I have a lot to say about it if it's ever appropriate, but there's just a lot of these early themes are in the show, even if the actual Foundation books aren't in the show, which I haven't read. So I have a very different perspective. Yeah.
Well, I think that's fascinating too, because I forget how much he weaved throughout his other stories too sometimes. But the thing that got me, so here's my problem with the show on first watching, it may affect other people similarly afflicted. And I recently actually sort of shotgunned it for this recording because I was like, oh, I haven't watched the first season for a while. I did watch the second. I rewatched some second season episodes. I'll just go back and skim through it. And I wound up watching a good hunk of it because the first time I watched it, the first season, my head is full of all these Asimov facts. So I'm watching it at that time with my 16-year-old, and they're like, what's going on here? And I stop and I explain, well, in the books, it's blah, blah, blah. And so I realized I had this ridiculous overlay of what I was expecting, and I couldn't totally shed it. When I watched it the second time, I was actually able to see it a lot more clearly for what it was without trying to tie it into everything Asimov, and I enjoyed it so much more. The second season was much more detached, so I didn't have that problem watching it initially.
I think one interesting thing about this too is, so clearly the showrunners have read all the stuff and they are picking and choosing, I think, very well in terms of what to adapt and how to adapt it. But we talked about scope just in terms of the production, like value and the design. I think it's also important to note the like scope of their planning. They are clearly planning a long involved story. I would highly recommend, by the way, if you enjoy this show, the Foundation official podcast, which was recommended to me by, I think, another listener of The Incomparable, is really good. It's David Goyer, who is the showrunner, talking, and they have different guests, and like including the actors or production people, VFX supervisors, all this stuff. It's really interesting. But what I love about it is you get very clearly that Dave Goyer is like, I have seasons. I have all these seasons planned out. And like, they'll ask him questions about stuff. He's like, I'm not going to tell you that, but I will say that if we get to season four, you will have that addressed in episode two or something. And it's like, oh, you know exactly where this is going. So to me, one of the things that's really enjoyable about that is they're not afraid. Like, we talked about season one being a slow burn, but they're not afraid to drop references or hints or just seemingly unanswered things. Like, for example, why does Harry have a body again? Who was the lady who gave him a body again?
We don't answer that question.
And Dave Gore's like, don't worry, we'll get to it in like season five.
I have theories. Heather, I think, has theories based on what she said before and after the spoiler horn too.
Right, but that's it's definitely a show where there's some level of complexity where they know where they're going. They're not making it up as they go along. And the scope, I just love, I mean, John mentioned about how this is very science fiction novel-like. And I explained that to somebody at some point. I said, look, I've been reading sci-fi novels a very long time, and very rarely do you get anything that feels like a sci-fi novel on TV or a movie, because they just can't do it for all the reasons John said. You can't, you got to boil it down. And this show doesn't have that problem. And it can lead, and I think in the first season does lead to a little bit of a dilution of forward motion where you're over here and then you're over there.
If you have no foundation, it can be like, what's going on? I think a lot of people bounced off because they're like, I can't make sense of this. There are too many people, too many characters, too many planets, and I can't keep track of it all. But it does settle down in your brain eventually.
Yeah. And you have to, You do have to pay attention. It's not one of those shows that you can do while you're also ordering a pizza. Yeah. Like, you need to pay attention to it, but it is, it does all tie in, and it really does reward those moments where you're like, oh, right. You're like, oh, that's that thing from that. And it does all kind of work, but it also allows that broad canvas, which is, you know, there's an episode where Brother Day goes to the planet of the monks and walks through the desert. And it's like,
love that episode.
So
is
good.
This show, right? And that is just, and then there you'll have a completely different episode set in a different place. The stuff that the twist that happened with the foundation, where you think the foundation is a certain thing, and then they're like, it's not that anymore. And you just kind of have to go with it. Like, I love those moments where I think, I have no idea what's going to happen on this show next, because they've shown that they could do whatever they want to do. But they also do, when it's at its best, it does have that forward momentum where you know it's going somewhere. And I think at its worst is when they get a little slow and you start to worry that it's going nowhere.
I think even with a little slowness in season one, there's kind of a mirror there, honestly, to the books, because the first book is... kind of a slog, and I remember very well reading it and then being like, all right, I guess I'll read the second one, and the second one picks up about halfway through and at that point you're like, oh, I'm into this now. So I feel like they had to front load a lot of stuff, and even them they were kind of aware, like, okay, yeah, we know it's a lot, we're gonna get there though.
The thing that kept getting me was you're trying to figure out who's in charge sometimes, right? And there's this element of the way they introduced the genetic dynasty, you're like, oh, well, here's three people, and they're just, you know, they're not aspects. They have their own sort of personalities. They're not, they make a point, and I think, I don't know if that comes back, that like, Cleon the First didn't just download his memory to clones. They all have to develop their own thing, and Demerzel is there to guide them through it. But there's a point at which I'm like, wow, some of these Brother Days particularly are acting really almost out of character, or sometimes they act impetuously. Sometimes the last one we see is that Cleon the 17th, I think, right, who gets blown up at the or thrown out the airlock. We're past the spoiler horn. Like, he seems really like almost incapable and like unable to master himself. And when you get the reveal that they're erasing parts of their memory, that she's shaping their experience, she's controlling them, I thought, wow, that it felt like a two season payoff of.
Well, was
this
that a reveal
behavior.
Though? Because that's the one place where I feel like the story put its foot wrong in season two. They try in season two, they try to have an episode where we're supposed to be, it's supposed to be revealed to us that Demerzel has been controlling them. It's like, that was obvious in episode one of the first season.
But
everybody
not
knows she's controlling them. Everybody knows that. I mean, why the Cleons don't know it? I mean, there's reasons for that. And why the people outside don't know that? Well, they don't see her or whatever. But like, if you're watching this show and somehow you don't realize that Demerzel is running this empire, I don't know. You must be doing laundry. And so when in season two, when they tried to make that reveal, I was like,
Oh, but the reveal isn't that she runs the empire. The reveal is she's trapped and they're trapped in this vicious cycle.
Well, she is a robot.
I think the reveal, too, is that they've injected different DNA and she's losing her ability to run the empire, right? Like,
there's multiple
things. It's spinning out into normal genetic chaos and Demerzel can't keep it together.
Well, also, don't forget, like, she's also... I think it's obvious just from the fact that everybody else dies
and she doesn't
that she's running things, but the scope of how she's running them, where she's actually making edits to memory and to genetics and that.
Yeah. I love that episode with her in pieces,
and that she is also trapped.
Yeah.
Those are the details that are circle. Like, oh, this is way worse than I thought. Right.
There are many more layers to her agenda that obviously have not been revealed, which is why I think, Jason, the episode that you referenced on the planet, I think is as much about Demerzel as it is about Cleon. Oh. Like, I think that episode is very purposeful about her and whether she has a soul and agency and who she really is. And I suspect that references her past very much. And we will find more out about that.
I will confess that I shouted out Ardenil Oliva at some point watching the early episodes.
Same. Like, oh, but that character is very different from that, the way they're portrayed in the books.
I enjoy the Empire being a bunch of doofuses as she herds them through their various dynasties, because they're just a bunch of boy doofuses. And she's there herding them along and manipulating them. And one of my favorite episodes, I think my favorite episode of the whole show, was the whole Demerzel in Pieces and her backstory and how the original Cleons inserted the You Have to Love Me programming, and now she's a slave to that. And I super want to get into the whole, like, oh, we killed all the computers Dune style, but you're the last one still alive. That's going to be
even
great
better
stuff.
Cleon the first is narrating. I mean, you forget that the episode is constructed so well. Cleon the first is narrating the thing he did to her. And he said she had a moment where she could have broken his neck. And
that's
oh, wait, he's talking.
The lesson
holographic
is destroy
form.
All humans with no hesitation.
Well, and they, I, not that, you know, this may not be a spoiler for people on the podcast, but I, in one of those interviews, Goyer said that basically they had like two more. Like, each season wanted to do a flashback for Demerzel, and the other two he mentioned were her as the general in the battle, and then her walking the spiral, because we know that she did it, but like to actually see like her backstory there and understand what's going on there. I mean, I think that character, to John's point, yes, you sort of get the sinister vibe from her right off that she is the competent one and she is doing this, but I think that the it's not the what, but the why and the how that is so compelling there. And that's what makes it a really good reveal insofar as it is that it isn't just like, this thing you think you know. It's like, no, there's, as Heather said, there's so many layers as to why this is happening, including layers of her agenda, quote unquote, that she doesn't even really want to do necessarily, but she has to.
Programming.
Can we say too, there's an interesting thing here is for the books that were written to be so, you know, masculine, male forward, women are incredibly secondary characters. The men are almost all, you know, they have agendas and most of the agendas are frustrated. They're unable to fulfill. The women are the only one who seem to have volition in the Foundation. I mean, arguably, maybe not totally true, but you have, you know, the two, Gael Dornick, Salver Hardin, and Demerzel. And Demerzel, I know, doesn't necessarily, but she has the requirement, if not the volition. So that becomes itself like, well, the dead hand of a dead white man has set her on this path. So I feel like there's kind of a play there that goes works for people just coming to the series initially, but it also works if you've read the Foundation series and think it's a very boring world that he describes, even with
all those characters are men in the books, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All three of them.
Yeah.
And she's a good, I don't know if this is from the books, but she's a very good incarnation of essentially the system, because she, by taking away that bit of agency from her, by saying she has to continue this dynasty because of the little programming inserted by Cleon One, she becomes the system in which all the other characters, including all of the Cleons, are ground up. Season over season, episode over episode. This system is grinding everybody up.
Right on.
And what is keeping that system going? Oh, there's no person doing it. It's just the system. And it's embodied by a robot lady who can survive with half her head cut off, who's doing stuff that she doesn't even want to do because the first Cleon made her do it, but she still loves them. And it's so like tragic and weird in a sci-fi way, and such a perfect physical embodiment of the thing we all feel is that collectively the system is bad, but individually, people are good and trying to do good things.
We'll call out actors later, I'm sure, too. But I just say, Laura Byrne, I mean, what a her performance is unique. It's just
best performance by someone with half a head.
Yeah.
That's a very specific Oscar category.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have to add new categories over time as the medium evolves.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
You know, what's really interesting about these books is that even from the very, very beginning, intelligence is embodied in all these books. That if you notice, there's no real computers. Even the jump ships, all of the intelligence is embodied. So Demerzel is embodied. The technology just isn't intelligence. It isn't intelligent. There isn't computers in this world in the way that we have them. That it's all about where does identity lie and where does intelligence lie, and it's all embodied. And is flesh and blood and versus, you know, metal and wire, and can the spirit reside in either? And from the very beginning of the short stories, way back when he, you know, because the Foundation series begins with these short stories about robots and the three laws about whether a robot can harm a human or not. And then they go to, can the robots, there's a short story about a robot that seems to spontaneously be able to break that rule. Which probably, I haven't read all the way through, but probably then leads to these books later. But all of the intelligence is embodied, which I just find fascinating. So to your point, Demerzel is trapped, but she's still embodied. There's just no computers here, which I just
yeah, she's
so
got,
interesting
she's got a
to me.
Soul. I mean, the fact
she
that they introduced
soul, right?
That she can see it and he can't, and that there's that chilling moment when Cleon is talking to her in his Cleon the First in his old age, and we're seeing him say, you know, talk about these half men, which is a chilling term, but and his children, that you'll raise them and love them, and you're like, suddenly had an image of like this sort of almost misshapen, almost, you know, just sort of these lumps that he's using to, he knows he's dying, he's not transferring his memory even though it seems like there's technology to do it, and he's leaving his dead hand running with a machine who has a soul, but like I still can't, I gotta say, I think this is maybe a personal limitation, I need some programming upgrade, I can't wrap my head around sort of what it is like to be those Cleons, because their memory is changed, they have awareness, and yet clearly they don't have, you know, something ineffable that she does.
Well, and then he plays around with this idea of clones, right? So the idea of not unique genetic material, but the same genetic material over and over and over and over again. And are they real people? Is there real soul in a clone? So I really think these books are all about identity and freedom and agency and what makes, if we use human in the sense of sentient, right? What makes an entity sentient and valuable and so full?
Just to be clear, the clones aren't in the books.
Yep. There's none of that.
They're in the show. Okay, but that's good to know since I haven't gotten there
yet. And the robots were not part of Foundation until a retcon much later on. They're a totally different series.
But they're in the book. So from, if you look to like, okay, what's the whole...
But that wasn't the Foundation. That's iRobot, which was not technically part of the series until later he went and was like,
it was
retroactively making
it part
of it.
To make them connected, but they weren't initially connected.
Well, but at some point he did, at least that's all of the stuff I read. So if he retconned them?
Yes.
Yeah. Asimov wrote some books very late on that said, oh, by the way, these characters from the robots universe, books were in the Foundation all along. And that was, and they wrote books to do that. But I think you're right.
The theme is still accurate. Thematically,
it's absolutely case. And I would also say it is a biological, portrayal of the degradation and decline of society, and you could also read it as a genetic decline. Is like, you know, you're talking about the Roman Empire, you talk about any royal dynasty where there's a founder who's like, aha, we're gonna do it this way, but they're mortal. And they're like, yeah, but my descendants. And it's like, yeah, but that's not how it works.
That's not a great system for choosing people is based on genetic material, which is kind of the problem with Empire. And this brings it to the nth degree where it's like, well, they're just all going to have the same genetic material. So problem solved, right? It's kind of the world's most perfect nature versus nurture sociological experiment. We'll have the same people with the same genes over hundreds of years. And just study them and you'll find out how much nature versus nurture, which is more important.
Mm-hmm. It has a metaphor too of, or made me think of generations. Loss, right? Like, you know, we used to tape, and it would just keep getting fuzzier and fuzzier.
Well, yeah,
and of course,
they do the genetic degradation / sabotage is one thing.
But
I think
it's as a metaphor. It works in terms of like the further and further they get. And I love the bits very early on with Dawn having to hide all his flaws.
That he has bad vision or whatever. Yeah.
He has bad, he's colorblind.
Yeah,
he's colorblind, and then he can't, like, he's out of sync with the others. And he's trying to pretend that he is in sync and trying to do everything the right way. And it's ultimately futile, right? Like, because he's going to get caught. But I love that whole, I think that whole storyline is kind of fascinating to watch because it does not go where I think it's going.
You know, there's a thing I haven't talked about, which is often a deadly part of sci-fi and fantasy, is this show can be very funny. I mean, genuinely funny, not like trying to be funny or whatever. I was thinking of the moment where Brother Dawn and Brother Dusk appeal to the hologram of Cleon, or the corpse of Cleon the First, and a hologram emerges, and they're like, is our genetic code to, he's not going to, no, they're going to, something's going to go wrong. My hand, if I put my hand up, he's not going to do it. And it's a great, like, comedic beat and timing, but it works, even though it's this moment where they're like, well, maybe we're about to get incinerated because we are not. Now we're just a slight bit off. And there are just moments throughout where I just laughed out loud and thought, I can't think of very many long series where they really have built in just that, the ease of being able to have something that's real, that's that not the characters are laughing at and we're not laughing at, you know.
Yeah, that's actually the span of the show. Yes. It can go from Demerzel, the physical embodiment of the system that's grinding people up, where they physically deconstruct her into multiple layers in case it's not, it's kind of like the Star Trek transporter saying these pieces when assembled make a whole, right? That's one end. And at the other end you have essentially, if you want to put it into a bucket, Han Solo in the form of Hober Mallow running around and being a scamp and having a big space pet with his monk monster girlfriend. And it's just, this is the same show, has both of those things in it.
And they work. And they both work.
I love him.
Yeah, well, and you could juxtapose, you got Jared Harris and Lee Pace, and like, I mean, on one level, it wants to say essentially at one end of the galaxy is the Emperor and at the other end is Harry Seldon. And that's not quite right. But you do have these two charismatic characters who are both doing very different things. And so that's an interesting dynamic. But then all the other pieces are there, including, you mentioned Hober Mallow. One of my favorite characters in season two is Bell Rios, played by Ben Daniels.
Love him so
much.
The
general who is then thrown in prison and then brought back out of prison and has his moment at the end with the Emperor. And when his beloved, his partner has died on the exploded planet, except he didn't die, which is a real Romeo and Juliet kind of thing there, right? But Ben Daniels' performance is so great, and he's just a guy getting ground up in the gears of Empire, who is actually seems like a decent person, but is essentially, you know, almost powerless to prevent,
despite being in a position of great power.
He was broken by his earlier experience. He rebelled. He's on the prison planet for years. He thought his husband was dead because they told him he was dead, and he finds out he's not, and he is essentially cowed. He's a broken man who is further broken, but it's a tragic story. You see the man he used to be, but then in season two, it's like, you know, I must obey my emperor.
Also, they totally blow up a planet at the end of season two, which I also thought was pretty cool, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, okay,
there's such a perfect moment. I mean, God, do I love the relationship with him and Gawain, I think, right? So it's pronounced where the fact that they're working so closely together, and that seems perfectly reasonable in the structure of the show, despite military discipline, it's fine. But when there's that bit where they land on the planet Sawenna, and the kind of the whole action sequence there between them. But then when they reach the guy who has been a loyal subject of Empire, who has been feeding incredibly good intelligence. Have you ever, I was like, oh my God, this really guy's the best intelligence operative working informally in the universe. And then he's like, shoot me in the head. He's like, what? It's like, look, they're going to all kill me. I just poisoned myself, but it'd be really nice if you killed me with a blaster. I thought that sort of, you know, I think there's something not to be admired about that, right? Also, but he was in a position of having no other choice, and Bell Rios doesn't hesitate. He gives the man the dignity that he asked for in the situation that this man had put himself into.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad because he had a really cool house.
Yeah.
He's in cool books.
Cool desert house.
We also have only briefly touched upon Gale and Salvor, who are two of our main characters.
God, that's another like two episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I first... Personally, although in my house we have a little bit of Gail's a bit of a dummy at times, but
she's our audience surrogate.
She's our audience surrogate. And sometimes a bit of a dope. But I think Salvor in particular is one of my favorite characters in the first two seasons.
Yep.
A totally unexpected character that they, I just think, do a great job with thrusting into these events and like having this whole battle over like, well, am I special? Like, what's my deal? And I just, yeah, she's really enjoy her.
She's a little bit of a chosen one character, but it's okay. She's a really good character. Also, I mean, season one, I don't know. Do they want us to be surprised that she's very clearly Gale's daughter? Because I thought that was really obvious, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because it is the surprise, the genuine surprise is that they end up together yeah. at about the same age.
Right. Yeah. She's older than her mother, in fact.
Older, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
More timey-wimey-ness.
That's great.
I've forgotten her. What's her partner's name too?
Hugo.
Hugo. I love Hugo. That guy, and I'm so glad they sort of almost bring him back for season two. Yeah. Like it was just
he's
nice to see
a
the
great
actor again
because
they are. Yeah, he's a good partner. They are a lot of fun together. They have great chemistry. And
another Han Solo-esque rogue.
I'm okay with it.
And Raish and Gale, I think they've made some incredible couples. I didn't even think about that, you know, because the show is imperial in nature and like galactic in scope. But I think Heather, you were talking about this earlier too. It's like there is a closeness to it. Like Raish is a fully realized character, even though he's barely in the show, and it echoes throughout. Gale has incredible complexity. We know a lot about her mother and father through relatively brief sketches, like the. Glaywin and Bel Rios, like this.
Constant and Hober Mallow. I love that plot line through season two. Oh, the two of them are so adorable together.
Harry and his wife and Yana and just on and on and on. So they've
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even the relationship, I thought one of the saddest moments is when Brother Dawn, which one is he? 14, I think, right? He, Cleon the 14th, the one who's colorblind, when he has this relationship with an actual rebel.
The gardener, yeah.
Who has a plant, which the gardener, a little hat tip to the Foundation books, is that the gardener is the person who kills Cleon the first in an unexpected move at some point, because he's mad about not getting promoted or something. But anyway, the gardener, that was one moment where I'm like, oh, she's a villain because this is in the books, but that relationship is very sweet. And at the end, when you know they reveal it all, and she's like, "It's not his fault. He didn't make himself into it. He's a tool." And I thought there is a level of compassion and sincerity about what she was doing to him when it was completely out of his control.
I like that plot a lot too, because even though it ends up being that like double cross, it's futile because the like empire is on top of it. Like that is to me, the best example of sort of this empire at the height of its power where it's like, oh, you know, you're rebelling against your dynasty and you're going to run away and everything. And they're like, oh no, we've been paying attention to this all along. You guys are all dead. Sorry.
It's the tragedy of anyone who's in sort of a royal position like this, that their view of the world is so narrowed that they're ill-equipped to affect any kind of an escape from it. They think
but
we from the outside see the shame. It's like, it's much like Game of Thrones where you see these people, you see them struggling in their situations, but you with the higher level view say, you're not going to make it. Like, don't worry, there'll be another one of you, but you specifically, it's not going to go well for you.
He gets his redemption in season two, too, right? Because he actually does get away.
This is the Crown season 16,000.
Yeah, you got to wait for things to really fall apart. Your other brothers have to be, you know, chucked out of an airlock and killed by Demerzel, and then you can escape.
Can we talk about Telamon and Metallics too? Because that is creepy as all get out.
It's bad news.
Oh, my God. Just heebie-jeebies.
Great, a surprising thread in season two, and I was going to mention this in a different context too, because we spend several episodes. I mean, it's one of the places we spend a lot of time on this planet with these telepaths, essentially, and they've got a cult leader, and she's like, "Hey, I'm your friend." She is not your friend. No. She is going to kill you and everybody else.
Unless she wants your body, then she won't kill you.
Yeah, that's right. She wants to feed on you because she's like a parasite who's immortal, who transfers herself from body to body.
And controls everyone else on the planet.
There was a real Get Out vibe going on there where she's like, I'll hear you echoing deep down for years to come.
Psychic vampire.
I enjoy also that I believe episode 6 and 7... end with somebody being drowned
in
her?
In a tidal pool,
like,
drowned in a tidal pool.
In the same pool?
So much water.
She just like, And Salvor, she just keeps trying, keeps killing people.
Yeah.
A necessary death. Sometimes, you know.
This show is about mothers and daughters and drowning, is a lot. What I think I'd say is like.
Also, interesting about this whole thing is it's also setting up actually one of the details from Asimov's Foundation books that the show has from of the voiceover that opens episode one of season one has acknowledged is maybe the most interesting thing in the books, which is the mule, who is a character. And the idea of the mule is he's a telepath, and it's a thing that Harry Seldon could not have predicted that threatens to overthrow his whole plan in order to, you know, sort of lower the time of the Dark Ages.
Why could he have predicted it?
It's a mutation.
Is it tachyons? Tell me if it's tachyons.
Telepathy, it's a mutation. It's the idea is it's an unexpected factor that was beyond what he planned
for.
Yes,
it's beyond math. So that's all way of our hands.
So the show, it's hyper math and imaginary numbers, John. So, but the idea there is cool that there's this powerful telepath out there who is going to, not now, but in, you know, several hundred years, threaten the stability of the galaxy even further. And so the telepaths in season two, the whole reason they're there is because Harry and company are like, we need to have telepathic stuff ready to go for the mule. And at the end of season two, it's very clear. It's like, well, next season, we're going to have to deal with the mule. Like, the mule is going to be this huge, presumably villainous character. Although how they handle that character, which is just he's just a guy with a magic power in the Asimov stories. How they do that, I'm also fascinated to see.
There's a lot with that character in the second book, which I think is some of the best executed stuff in that series.
I think it is the best stuff in the Asimov material is the mule.
But
the
fun part about that is just as an interesting fact from the podcast I heard was the reason David Goyer says they eventually went with Apple TV to sell this series was it was the only people that didn't basically say you have to start with the mule because everybody wants to see the mule, and they're like, no, this is like season three, and they're like, okay, you can do season three.
There's a motion which hasn't come up yet, and I don't think it's a spoiler because it is in decades old books, but one of the mule's abilities is to cause people to essentially think faster, right? They make leaps of intuition, and he's kind of killing somebody in the book by making him work so hard, but to get what he needs, what the mule needs. And I do think there are elements, just like we see Tellum Tellum Bond say, well, I'm the reason, you know, you made that effort in Synax is I prompted you to do that across, you know, light years, across the galaxy. I wonder if the mule, not even retconning, if it'll turn out that some of what has led to him existing is that he is been pushing that to happen. It's unclear if he can do it through time. I mean, he looks when
he
Gale,
see it through time.
Looks,
Gale.
Yeah,
because Gale goes but he's in the future with her. So, but that is a chilling moment when he says, "I can see you." I can't remember the exact line, but that he can see her in the past. And I was like, "Whoa, that is a lot."
That is one of the most intriguing parts. I think that, and I'm curious the retconning, as we discussed, of the robot stuff into Foundation sort of has a culmination in the books. And I am super curious to see if they are still going in that direction, because the stuff they have done with Demerzel would seem to belie at least some of that.
Well, Heather, can I ask you, made a mention about plural robots before we started. I'm curious if you have a theory, because I have a theory, and I wonder if it's the same one or if we all have the same theory.
I guess I wondered at first if the woman that re-embodied Harry was Yana, but I don't think she is, right?
No.
That's one of the things I couldn't tell. So then I wondered if that was a robot, and I wondered if that character that embodied Harry was a robot. So that's some of what I was thinking.
I was thinking that poet, mathematician, not Kellen, I'm thinking of her name wrong.
Right, that's who it was. So that is who,
they
that
say that
is
who
embodied
it, but she's supposed to have been
Harry,
dead,
right?
Forever.
And she doesn't,
so she must be a robot.
And they don't detect a life form, and she seems to be able to control electronics or relays. So I was thinking she's probably a robot, because
she's
then she's like, well, I'll probably see you again. And you're like, well, how, where, when?
Probably why she's hidden away, because they're not supposed to be around anymore, right?
Yeah,
they're not allowed.
She's pulling a Yoda.
That's right. Yeah. I'm hiding on this.
No, but planet. There's a moment. I want to say in episode 10, there's a moment where Demerzel, maybe it's episode 9, where they actually make reference to the laws of robotics.
Yes.
And I laughed, because I was like, well, Asimov, how could you not? But and I wonder rights wise, like I assume that they don't actually have the rights to the iRobot books, but they presumably have the rights to all the Foundation novels, which includes those kind of like, so I wonder if it's like, it's not obviously going to be a, I was a detective on the moon once, right? Like, it's like, no, I'm not going to do it like that. But the idea that you take that raw material of like robots hiding in the galaxy and guiding what happens, that's really interesting. And so you spread that out and say, well, you know, it's Demerzel, yeah, but it's not just Demerzel.
Demerzel says the really large, the very large robots hidden very large places, the very small robots hidden very small places. And I thought, that is a cookie crumb. She says they're all destroyed, but I'm like, well, what's a very large place? Is that a ship? Is it a city?
Trantor, the whole planet is a robot.
It could be. It's a transformer.
Imagine.
Yeah. I mean, clearly they're all still out there, right?
You have the rights to that?
Well, obviously. So this show has important lessons to us. I said before, the lesson is if you were robots, don't hesitate when you have a chance to kill all the humans, because that was her downfall. And the other lesson is, hey, if you're exterminating all robots, make sure you get them all.
Get them all. Yeah, that's right. Come with the king. Best not miss, right?
Yeah, you leave just one or two and you got problems.
The Blade Runner rule, I think.
Well, it begs the question, why was Demerzel left? Why was she not destroyed? Why was she just disassembled in such a bizarre way, right?
I'm sure we'll find out. Torture her.
I think he wanted to torture her. She talks about how he did things to make her cry, and then she did it.
But is that... But I assume that's because he found her, not because...
Right, like, why was she there to begin with? Why was...
She was the one survivor before then.
Oh, he captured... He said she captured her. He captured the general of the army, and then he experimented on her.
But how did she survive?
He took her.
She was the last one.
He could have killed her, but instead he split her up into 17 different panes in the visible
to torture her.
No one had been there for 5,000 years.
Wow.
That'd be a little boring. No Wi-Fi.
Well, no, because the Cleon eventually found her and they had conversations over the course of his entire life.
Right. Which is another, that's a very Doctor Who.
And all the while she's thinking, I'm patient, I'll eventually kill you. And she hesitated moment.
The girl in 15 pieces in the fireplace.
Most likely kill you in the morning.
Mm-hmm, but she meant it.
So, and this is, the more we talk about it, I'm like, oh yeah, that too. Like, that's the thing that I really love about the show. And I gotta say, so my way through it was, I saw people saying like, whatever. I watched a couple episodes and I thought it was okay. I went back to it a little bit later. We watched the rest of them. Lauren and I were like, it was fine, right? We didn't love it. And it came back and we're like, well, should we watch that? And we got to it late. It had already put out like 5 episodes when we started. But then we started watching it and we're like, oh, yeah, this is like, let's do another one. And it built the momentum that way. And it every week, every episode, I would think, there's something in here that is going to surprise me or is going to be something I just don't expect to see on TV. And the scope, again, like I said earlier, the scope is so wide that you do risk confusion and loss of narrative momentum. It's always a problem when you have multiple storylines where you're like, everything slows to a crawl, even if the story is still progressing. Like if you cut between 5 different stories,
it takes too long to make progress along all the concurrent threads.
Exactly. You're stuck in the mud a little bit. And they got better at that in season 2. But the scope and the fact that all these different things are happening and that there's the whole like season 2 story about the queen who comes in and she's all rebellious. But like in the end, I'm going to kill everybody. I've already killed everybody, you know, and you know, we're smashing.
Yeah, that's one thing
everything.
Season 2 like, did is they introduced a bunch of new characters and they're all great. I love the queen and her and the former concubine and their whole subplot. And again, Brother Constant and Polly is an adult.
Oh, and Constant
and Polly.
So good as the priests of another fun thing is like, oh no, it's very scientific. Mm-hmm. I'm a psychohistorian. It's very scientific. And they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start a religion now.
Not only a religion, but also like, you know, to Heather's point earlier about the technology and how it's mostly embodied. The Foundation priests use technology as magic, right? They're doing the magic as indistinguishable technology.
Not fantasy magic, Las Vegas magic.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And which is a brilliant, beautiful moment as they're putting on their like terrible shows of like,
oh my
look
God.
At me as I amazingly
and the,
do
the
this
best thing.
Thing
is, though, like, that's not to say that they're not true believers, because they are. They just do what they think they have
others.
To do.
Well, and then Harry meets them and he's like, oh, you're at the church stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Because, of course, he predicted the whole thing.
And
right.
I think Polly is so interesting in that way, too. I love the conversation he has with Constant about faith versus, you know, believing. He's like, well, I was there, right? Like, I met him as a kid.
Yeah.
So I could never really. Exactly. I didn't have the faith of, like, just having the stories. And I thought that was a beautiful moment.
You know, it's worth pointing out, and I'd forgotten this until rewatching. The show opens with four kids, kind of gangly kids doing stupid kid things, sneaking out, doing something dangerous, hurting themselves. It's like, and then being discovered by the wonderful Salvor Hardin, right, and rescued. And then Polly, the fact that you get him because of his long life. We don't know how long people are supposed to live in that, you know, in those worlds, but that he comes back without any contrivances. He's just 110 or whatever, and that's just what it is. Yeah, it's such a surprise every little bit. I say the most chilling thing I may have ever seen in a, I'm trying to think if this is true, but in my heart, I think the most chilling spoken thing that I didn't see in a piece of visual entertainment is when Cleon explains to the gardener that they've targeted every single person related to her alive
and
has ever had anything to do with her. And then one gesture and they're all dead. And I thought, you're like, the scope is impossible, but it's approachable because he lists the numbers. It's not just all the people you know. He's like, it's this many people. It's all the cousins and brothers and nieces and grandparents, you know, and so forth.
And there's a creepy callback to that in season two, because we go back to that same spot where he like has that conversation with her, with the queen. There's like a scene where they're in that same little like garden in the pool. And like, there's a moment there of tension as it's like, well, I know you're kind of plotting against me, but like we're kind of, it's not right out in the open quite yet. And I think the show is very deft about handling those little things that are like little references and tips of the hat to stuff that came earlier. Mm-hmm.
Remember what this guy is capable of.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Exactly.
And it's Empire. I mean, that's the other thing is that Empire, one of the things that I enjoy about the show is that it does a good job of mixing the remove that you can have when you're in those classic kind of like we're in the capital, we're in the castle, there's various palace intrigue and the brutality of enforcing your rule out in the world. And the show does, I think, a pretty good job of showing both of those things. And yes, there's also brutality in the castle. That's also true. But it does both. And so there are moments where, this is this beautiful garden and we see this spot and we're like, oh yeah, that's where he commanded that everybody who ever knew this person was assassinated in a moment, which is, absolutely brutal. But then they do the same thing essentially to the queen.
Yeah.
Where they're going to destroy everything in her family.
That was almost like, that wasn't even like it was some kind of like revenge thing or whatever. Like, we just need to do this to push your chess piece into the position we want it to be in.
We want you to come.
How can we make that happen? Well, if we kill everybody, she'll probably come. Because the other siblings weren't as conducive.
The message of, you know, doofus with almost infinite power, which, you know, resonates a little bit.
At various times in the seasons, Dawn has his own tragic seriousness, but Day at various times, the different days have their moments where they think, I'm going to be the good one. And you watch them try to, it's like they're genetically predisposed not to be able to do the right thing, but boy, do they try, and it just never ends well.
Yeah, full credit to Lee Pace for making these people who are supposedly genetic, you know, copies of one another feel like distinct characters, because season two Day is very different from season one Day. In particular, I mean, that opening scene, right, in season two in the bedroom where he fights off the assassins and everything, and he's like running around naked, and you're just like, this guy is really full of himself, right? And like, he pays for it right at the end where he has his brawl, you know, and he's like, I don't need the stupid shield thing, right? I'll just take you on. You're like, this is dumb. Why would you do that? But it's like, we have established this is who this guy is. This is this particular genetic quirk copy.
He's doofus number 17 in the series.
Yeah. Most holy doofus of them all.
Oh, yeah. What else have we not? I mean, we talked about a lot, because there is a lot. That's the thing about the show. There is a lot.
I got two little things.
Yeah.
Well, one is, what an incredible storytelling device is the active chroma, the painting that moves.
Ooh. And
yeah, that's good stuff.
It's beautiful. It's a great use of CGI. Like it feels like
it looks great too.
Yeah, looks great. It fits thematically, and the idea that every Brother Dusk's job is to kind of work on it, and even
I was gonna say it's Chekhov's painting
exactly
too. Right.
I like that it's the hobby of the older one, because people just ignore. Oh, he's the old man. We can just ignore him, and it turns out ignore him at your peril, because there are important things in those stupid. It's like the old guy. Traitor. He's just got his paintings and the magic. Paints that move around. Isn't that nice for him?
The things that about the traitor, with the green stripes and everything. Like, that's such a great little.
And then, and that ties, and then you get the Dominion. That's how it's brought into there. The other one is over 15,000 years of human society expanding into space. Bras cannot be improved on, judging by the Gardner's bra. So it cracked me up when I got to say the whole thing is so space age. He unzips her jacket and it's just a normal bra. And I thought, well, okay, I guess you can't improve on a space. No, there were no lasers. There was no magnetism.
That planet is
there was
in
no
space.
Combination.
The planet they were on, it's in space.
That's in space.
We're all in space, John.
All
it's true.
Bras are space bras now.
I will chime in. The music is pretty good in this show. Bear McCreary, who did the music for Battlestar Galactica, among other things, I think does a really nice job. I've listened to both the first and second season soundtracks. I think the theme's pretty good. I like the opening credit, even though I skip credits fairly often. I do enjoy the opening credits for this. I think they're effective. It's part of the production. The spaceships, like, especially when you get that, like, first of all, the Anacreon, the Invictus is a cool ship. And then you get all the, like, Empire jump ships and stuff later on that are also really well designed and interesting. And you've got the spacers. We didn't really talk about the spacers.
Yeah, the spacer slaves. We don't have computers, but we have an entire race of people that we enslaved due to their dependence on some nutrient.
Yeah. They used to be
very
Belters.
Dune.
Very catch yourself white.
The Invictus is awesome because it's like, oh, we have a giant derelict super powerful spaceship, like Tough Voyaging
also,
is a callback for those who've read that.
Yeah, there's a thing in there that is not explained. The EXO is written on like the navigation thing, and they're like, oh, must have run into something from like outside the galaxy. Yeah, let's not really worry about that. That is a thing apparently that will come back maybe someday, but I love that they will drop those things and be like, yeah, that's for 5 seasons from now.
The Flying Dutchman.
And I did like, I mean, that's a great sci-fi trip of like, it, when you have sci-fi books, it seems, especially the harder ones, they try to, if you have some big powerful spaceship, they try to give some kind of hand-wavy explanation of the power that it required to do what it does. And the Invictus destroys a planet because to do what it does requires technology and powers that have the ability to do that if chucked into it. And that is, you know, normally you have the ships like, oh, how are they going to blow up a planet? They'll shoot it a bunch with guns. It's like, no, there's a black hole and a singularity, and that'll do your planet for you,
but not your vault.
I think the spacers are really beautiful characters. Just love how they made them and the thought that would go into if these entities, these people live, you know, genetically modified to live out in space, and just, and the embedded like crystals or whatever are in their skin. I just think they're really beautiful.
I love their names too.
They have like Native American
bends
names.
Light or whatever.
She Bends Light. And again, with the relationship thing, we only see She Bends Light and she is Central, I think it's called. She's called. They only are together for a moment and beautifully directed, beautifully acted.
You can feel that relationship. And I love that they said, yep, F you, we're done. We'll take the deal.
Right.
Yeah. I know, Dan, you said you I don't know what you thought about Gail, but I really like her and I love her as a foil for Harry. Harry is driven. He's intellectualized. He really very rarely shows emotion. He clearly cares for Gail, and obviously he cared for his wife and his unborn child, but he is so driven and he really tends to just plows through whoever's in front of him. And I think, you know, part of who Gail is she is his intellectual equal, but she's not gonna, you know, she really works to not do that. She works to connect and she works to keep him and her aware of the people that are around them, and that the people are not just bowling pins to knock down, but that the decisions that they make in the psychohistory, there are people, there is a psycho in the history, right? there's psyches here, and these are real people. And I appreciate that about her and how hard she fights him. And I think just like Harry, she loses her way in the fight to humanize what they're doing. So just, you know, like Harry, Harry gets too intellectualized. I think Gail gets too emotional. But I like the pairing in that way, that they both have their, they're both messy in different ways. And I really like the two of them together. And it's, they're kind of like two people running a sack race, and it's very messy, and they're loping around. But I think the two of them are going to get us across the finish line in the end. And I really think it's a, quite a clever pairing together.
I do agree.
Really,
I think
it's a sack race, but over 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Or 100,000 years.
I dig that when someone's being gaslit in a TV series, there's somebody else there who's like, nope, you're not going to do this to me, and here's why. Uh-huh. And she gets proven right, and she gets to take her position. I mean, that's actually literally, they're side by side, and she's taken her rightful place for what she's earned in the last episode of the second season. I also want to mention very briefly the fact that there are three religions, take all sort of different in this series. I don't think, I mean, you know, the one that's, you know, the foundation religion is sort of confabulated and intended to be something, you know, to sucker people, but also people believe in. But the mother, the religion of the mother, the crone, and the maiden, 3 trillion followers, and it's not laughed at. You know, it's presented in a serious way within the context. And often, I think a lot of shows and books, well, shows particularly more than books, try to avoid insinuating anything about religion. And then you have the religion, the sleeper religion, that Gail is contending with, that she's wrestling with, that her leaving the faith, wonderful scenes in the church on Trantor, incredible stuff.
Well, and her, is that like almost like her upbringing too? Yeah, the water plant.
Yeah, that she had to basically separate from her entire culture, her family, everything. She had to disappoint everyone in her life to do what she did.
Yeah. No, I was. She still
got the scars from the things. I love that they're gonna have to keep putting them on every season after season. But it's a reminder of what she sacrificed to be where she is.
It's just everything is drowning over and over again. Drowning, 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 drowning. It's just a lot of repetition.
Yeah, one of my favorite things in season two was Queen Sereth and her advisor, former concubine. Their whole interaction, like it's. It's another situation where a young person in a royal context is in over their head, and you kind of know it too. But to see her struggle, and to see her, what is her assistant helper person's? I can't find the
Rue.
Character name.
The enjoiner.
Rue.
Yeah. Oh, Rue.
When it's revealed that she had recovered her edited memories, and so it's like as ill-equipped as they are to deal within their royal confines, even they have a leg up on Empire, because that, you know, the old guy's like, I remember you when I was young and we did all these things and you don't remember because your memory was edited. And he's like, yes, memory was edited. It's just the two of them plotting and trying to move forward and disagreeing about the right path forward, and her being in the end the queen who's kind of in charge of everything, and having had her whole family killed, and having that kind of be a chip on her shoulder, the whole thing. Like, and that actor, I love that actor, that just that one tiny plot line off in the corner. It's like, I would just love to see a whole show about those guys and how they resolve all that.
And that scene where Sereth like upstages Day when he announces her, that's like such a kick-ass scene. I love that scene.
A
so
great
good.
Acting from both of them in there. Lee Pace too, being the like getting so kicked in the teeth.
And eventually almost gets eaten by a space creature.
Yeah. There's also a theme of abusive fathers, which is not unusual in history, but Harry Seldon has one. Raish's father collapses under the weight of the disease he has. Not Belrios, but Hober Mallow talks about his father being abusive. The Cleons technically have an abusive father. Like, there's, I think,
Harry Seldon does incinerate that one guy.
Oh, Harry's, kind of Harry's
the
dad.
The religious father figure is like, sometimes you got to make a point and incinerate a guy, you know.
Yeah, it's not.
That guy wasn't he like the militia leader? Or
he
something?
Was kind of a jerk.
He was
still,
a warden. He was a warden, but he was a jerk. I mean,
we wanted Hober Mallow to be in flames on the side. Why don't you just send an email, dude?
Oh, because sometimes you got to be a vengeful god.
Exactly, right? He's totally like, I this is the Old Testament program. Go see the other Harry Seldon. Oops, I've said too much.
Oh my God, when he says, "I'm the left hand," that is one of the funniest things.
That's such a great moment. Oh God, I'm the left hand, aren't I?
That's so good.
Well, that bit in the whole, like, the timey-wimey as we discussed before.
Well, I must have known that I would figure this out. So.
Yeah, Homer Mallow, let me tell you about, I'll give you that information. He's like, "Oh, you shouldn't have told me that." And it's like, wait a second, that already happened, or did it?
Bum, bum, bum.
Yep. Yeah.
Clever show.
Wild stuff. Clever show. Good stuff. Well, it's renewed for a third season and it's coming back.
Hooray!
So there will be more of Foundation and more for us to talk about next time.
Let me just say Terrence Mann. Incredible performance. Oh, yeah, Terrence Mann. He's amazing. Amazing in every iteration.
Okay. Little Terrence Mann throw in there. Good old Brother Dusk. Dusk, all of those brother actors.
Yeah, the guy who plays the young one is like,
oh, man.
He is apparently, you know, he tells the story, he was interviewed on the podcast and he's like, "I was like working in a movie theater making popcorn and I ran out to go to the audition and I was like, I'm not gonna get this." And he's very good
stuff. All right, I would like to thank my panel for being here to talk about Foundation a little bit. Glenn Fleischman, thank you.
Thank you. I did observe all the rules, Jason, as you noticed.
I appreciate it. Dan Morin, thank you.
Please enjoy the piece.
John Syracuse, thank you.
I'm going to put myself in cryosleep, and you just wake me up when you name me to podcast.
You got it. And Heather Berberet, thank you.
Hey, how many robots were there, actually? Thanks, Jason.
You got to keep counting. Keep counting the robots.
Gonna
you
keep
never
counting.
Know. They move. You got to keep counting them.
Was it a Zeppelin X?
Thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. The other Incomparable is stationed at the other end of the universe, but on this side, it's mine. We will see you next time.